When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, we'll react to events at the Emirates Stadium as Arsenal stay top of the Premier League with victory over Liverpool. So many penalty decisions to debate this weekend, VAR handballs as well. We'll get into all of those, including the ones at Goodison Park and at the London Stadium as well. We'll talk about a positive evening for Cristiano Ronaldo and Manchester United, Gary O'Neill's credentials to be the future Bournemouth boss, the European Super League, the Lionesses' win over the world champions United States, and we'll react to the false coming out of the former Spain goalkeeper Iker Casillas and what that means for LGBT players in the game. This is The Game. Hello and welcome to The Game Podcast. I'm Hugh Wissencroft alongside Gregor Robertson, Tony Cascarino and Alison Rudd on a rather cold Monday morning. But the weekend provided us with the heat. Something to enjoy anyway. It came at the Emirates Stadium. There are a few, to be fair, end-to-end games across football this weekend. It's been a pretty level Premier League season so far in terms of quality for most of the league. Obviously, we know a couple of clubs are showing real quality, and namely Arsenal, top of the Premier League. A 3-2 win over Liverpool at the Emirates Stadium. It was a game that gave us so much to discuss, but ultimately Liverpool are now 14 points behind the leaders. So Jurgen Klopp felt the big moments just went against his side in what was a pretty chaotic game. Really, two questions come from this. Liverpool, title gone. Arsenal, title on. What do we think? Alison Rudd. I've got to say, the Arsenal fans are desperate to hear you give their side some credit, finally. Is today the day?
Yeah, no, they're playing well. But you don't need to play that well against Liverpool at the moment, do you? I mean, the funniest thing of all was afterwards, Mikel Arteta felt he had to big up Liverpool to say, I think they're going to play well in the next few games. Because who have they got next? They've got Manchester City. And if Arsenal are going to stay top of the league, they need City to keep dropping the odd point now and then. And he felt, I mean, we've reached the point where an Arsenal manager feels he has to give Liverpool a bit of a boost, make them feel a bit better about themselves, so they might just get a draw against Manchester City.
That's his faint praise, isn't it?
very faint praise. Yeah,
we've talked a lot about how what Arteta's done is gone in and made a flaky club strong, and he's got rid of personalities he doesn't like. He's prepared to invest in youth and keep playing the youth, and for there to be an ethos. What we know from the documentary about him and from everything he says post and pre-match these days, it's all about emotion for him, which I find very strange. I don't think you win the title by talking about how you handle a game emotionally. But if that was the main problem with Arsenal, their mentality, then he's getting that right. The key thing, I think, is that the fans believe it. They like him and they believe in the project. So that what you don't get now at the Emirates is this disgruntlement as soon as things go wrong, which I think hampered them horribly. I don't think you can overstate what that must be like to play in. You're a big club with big stature like Arsenal, but your fans, it's not that they turned on the team regularly, it was just that they made it plain this was not acceptable. And then you could see them wobble towards the end of quite a lot of games they should have been winning. The atmosphere in the game against Liverpool was one of belief. Even when Liverpool equalised twice, it was one of belief. There wasn't that, self-fulfilling prophecy, or it's going to go wrong again. So if you get, I think Arteta's done very well in making that a sort of around the club feel, you know, from the stands onto the pitch in the dressing room. We can do it. We have the ability to do it. Which, you know, you want me to keep praising them? I'll keep doing it. I think that's probably the most important thing. And I think people also said they're a team that are too young. Where are the leaders and so on? But I mean, footballers are just getting younger and younger. And I think they're showing a maturity simply because the manager's told them he believes in them. So, yeah, excellent. Excellent stuff from Arsenal. Yeah.
Tony, you were there.
Full gritted teeth.
Yeah. Tony, you were there.
Yes, obviously.
How good were Arsenal / how bad were Liverpool? Would a draw have been a fair result?
Well, Arsenal beat a mid-table team. So let's get that one out of the way, first of all, foremost, is Liverpool are a mid-table team at the moment. And they've had a huge amount of games this season so far where they've played really poorly, whether it's Napoli, whether it's Fulham at the start of the season, Crystal Palace, Man United. You know, there's quite a number of games already. If Liverpool hadn't a beat, and I know this is hypothetical, but if they hadn't a beat Bournemouth 9-0, they'd have a minus goal difference. They'd have one minus one. That 9-0 victory makes their goals column look far better. I didn't agree with Klopp's formation, start of the game. I was on radio last weekend this week and I talked about the worry of the wide men, Trossard, with Brighton going up against Trent. And it's not just Trent the problem, but behind him is a problem. What happens in spaces behind him that get exposed? That happened with Trossard. I said it yesterday morning. Martinelli is a problem for Liverpool. But it wasn't just Martinelli. It ended up being both wide men were a problem against Liverpool. Van Dijk is so off his game. I can't believe I'm still having conversations with people who say he's the best centre-half in the world, or one of them. Well, he hasn't been that for quite a long time. And he certainly hasn't played that well, certainly this season. And I'd add into that, playing two in midfield with Thiago is a problem in itself, because Thiago's a fabulous footballer, can't make a challenge. He's not a winner of the ball. Liverpool have gone away from that three-man midfield. When they had Wijnaldum, Henderson and Fabinho, they would literally chase all over the pitch, win the ball, they'd fill in for each other, and when they got it, they could move it quickly to the forwards. Mo Salah was like a young lad making his sort of early games. Mo Salah's a tremendous player, and I'm watching him hardly have the ball. And when he does, he's trying to make things happen, and it's not happening for him at the moment. Mo's off his game, and there was a number of reasons why Liverpool are poor, but I did think yesterday's formation, they had Thomas Partey, Odegaard and Xhaka. And them three all played against Liverpool yesterday, all creating problems in different ways. Xhaka was taking chances getting forward. Partey was sitting and kept picking up the loose balls, moving it quickly. And Odegaard was, when he was on it, he was doing things literally on the edge of Liverpool's box. And they paid a huge price for that. Liverpool at the moment are a mid-table team and no more. So this title challenge had gone after I watched the Man United defeat. When they lost to Man United in the manner they did, Liverpool weren't for competing this year for the title.
Totally gone for you?
I just thought that day, I thought, this isn't a team that's going to compete for the title.
But is it over?
Yeah. Oh, well, without a doubt. Yeah? Okay. You know, Man City... We'll talk about Arsenal or whatever, Man City, but from I'm talking basically as a Liverpool fan and probably should have give Arsenal... And Alisson touched on it. There was something incredible about Arsenal that you can't really get from TV as easy as you can see when you're there. Every time the ball went out of play, they dashed to the ball, got it and threw it in. Just high intensity
purpose.
Just get it in as quick as they could all the time. And it felt they kept catching Liverpool, even with simple throw-ins.
Yeah, no, that was the biggest... The most jarring thing for me is that, you know, that energy, that lack of energy that you recognise, you associate with Liverpool, and particularly that midfield three, is gone, and it's there with Arsenal now. It's really there. And like, I don't know, also the way they kind of respond to setbacks now too, that it's, you know, it's something new. It's...
Can I ask you all a question? Did anyone find it weird that Klopp turned his back not to watch the penalty?
Yeah, kind of.
It felt like it was a World Cup final.
I
didn't get it. I was like, why are you turning your back on a penalty against Arsenal in a Premier League game? This is not the Champions League final where you're really, you know... He's turned it. I thought that was weird.
Maybe he thought it was such a disgraceful decision that he had to turn his back on it in form of protest.
It was a nonsense.
Yeah.
Yes.
Don't think it was a pen.
No.
No, I didn't either, but then soft. You know, I thought it was very soft.
I just don't want it to be a penalty in any world that we live in.
We're seeing a lot of this now, I think. And look, we'll talk about VAR, but there are a lot of soft decisions now. But I do think the players have noted on super slow motion, on VAR.
Yeah.
The slightest touch can look like a pretty serious foul. Like they've noted, it doesn't take a lot to retrospectively give a decision. So if you get touched, just go down, appeal, because then they'll definitely have a look at it, roll around for a bit, and they'll probably give it. I mean, it wasn't given on VAR, but it wasn't overturned either.
Do you know what's happening? There's soft decisions in the 18-yard box, but not in the centre of the pitch.
Yeah,
they're waving on in the centre of the pitch. And you know the old argument of, oh, if that would have been in the penalty area, that wouldn't be given, or, you know, that sort of argument. And I'm thinking, well, now we've got to the stage where it's soft in the 18-yard box, but in the middle of the field, it's not. You're waving play
like,
on.
We'll let the game go. And I think most of us are quite enjoying that. But then you see the exact opposite, like
in the
just decisions
box.
That shouldn't be given. And yeah. But look, Arsenal were brilliant. You know, despite that and that penalty call, I think they deserve to win. I think Klopp was wrong. It wasn't a draw. And the energy that they have, Martinelli is becoming a star, a real star. And Saka was outstanding as well. Both wingers, how direct they are, the kind of pace on the break. And they've got authority in the middle of the pitch now, which was always kind of completely absent for so long. Mm. You know, spoken so much about Saliba and keeping Partey fit as well.
Yeah.
I just think it's so important. You know, this is the thing that happens now. Everyone goes, right, okay, are Arsenal a title contender? And you think, what would make them fall away? And you think, look at injuries. And there's parts of the team actually where you think, you know, I think, okay, Saliba, you could bring him, move Ben White in and they'd probably
they'd
do all right.
Yeah.
I think if they lost Partey, they're in trouble.
Yeah.
Partey, and he's had an injury, you know, he's had a bad record at Arsenal. So he's the only one. I mean, you know, Jesus as well has been such an impact. They're the two really, I think. But otherwise, this is a strong squad and Arsenal, I think, you know, they're showing that they can go deep into the season challenging. I don't think they're going to win the league, but I think they can go deep into the season as a challenger.
The problem with Liverpool, though, is I think when we look back at the season, I don't know where we'll finish, but it's strange. It began with domestically with Fulham going to Anfield. It was lunchtime kickoff, and I think people thought, oh, well, sometimes teams take a while to get going because Liverpool had just beaten City in the Community Shield and were thinking they're looking good, Liverpool. They're looking as slick as they were last season. But the interesting thing was that Fulham had no fear and they had high energy levels and pressed and Liverpool was slightly astonished. And you get into this rhythm where, and then Napoli did the same thing. They had no fear when they played Liverpool in Europe. So as soon as you see a pattern emerging, everyone else piles in and they think, you don't have to be scared of Liverpool anymore. Mm. We can go for them. Look at their high line. Just win a few balls, we're in. Mm. And they had an aura. There were games Liverpool won when they won the title that they shouldn't have won. They won it purely on aura. And I think teams being slightly scared to play their own game. Now, we're now in the snowball effect so that it's going to keep on happening. Teams will not be scared of Liverpool because teams like Fulham and Napoli have shown the way. If you just have no fear, they will crumble. And I agree with you 100%, Tony, about the formation because it's so counterproductive. The sort of attacking third of the pitch is so congested now. There's no room for a player like Salah anymore. Where does he go? He's supposed to be a winger now or what? There's nowhere. It's congested. Basically four attackers. I just think there's always going to be one player who's not doing very much because there's no space for them. It's just like overload for no good reason. Nunes played really well because that suits him because he's an old-fashioned centre-forward. But everybody else looks a bit lost.
I think all the things you're saying about Liverpool there, again, you can flip them on their head for Arsenal. Like how much higher they're playing up the pitch, the influence of Saliba, and that it just inspires confidence that if the ball goes to the top, he's just kind of eats up the ground. And that one where he was chasing back and he kind of leaned him off the ball on the touchline. It was Diaz. It's just like such authority. It gives everyone so much more confidence. And there's just a lot of things. I think that's part of what Arteta's talking about when he speaks about emotion too. It's them being in that frame of mind and having that kind of front foot authority.
Do you
just actually being the team that are going to go and stamp their authority on the game. That's, I think that's what he's talking about, and that's what they're showing, and that's what Liverpool have lost.
Trent Alexander-Arnold. I didn't like the cameras. They constantly cut to him. How many goals were his fault? Is there an issue? Is there a situation? How do you solve it? Or do you just keep playing Trent Alexander-Arnold?
Well,
until
keep playing him because he's got a... Well,
apart from the injury, but I mean...
Injury now.
Without the injury, how would you have solved that situation? What would you have done next if you were Jurgen Klopp?
I mean, Jurgen Klopp would have kept faith in him, undoubtedly. But like the first one was a brilliant goal. Brilliantly worked goal. Really kind of a dynamic, you know, attacking move. But that's kind of what Trent's issue is, actually. That those balls in behind and being, you know, caught unawares, not really being at the right body shape, things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
The second one felt like me. He was trying to overcompensate for the things that have been going on before. He saw he's kind of edging, hoping he was going to take a big touch out of his feet, ran over, and Martinelli cut back brilliantly, and him and Jordan Henderson were sent for a taxi. So the second one felt more like, to me, he was compensating. It was like in his mind. He knew he'd messed up for the first goal. He knew he was under the spotlight. But Klopp would have kept going with him. There's no question about that. And you know, I don't see what else he could do.
Well, the idea was that Jordan Henderson always sits in for whenever Trent ventures too far forward. Yesterday, Trent got caught a few times, and it isn't a Trent problem, just Trent. It's the back line. They're vulnerable when teams, especially when the ball's being won in front of them and they're coming onto Liverpool. Liverpool are so susceptible to that high line, ball in between, centre-half and full-back. They're in trouble. So you have to get squeezed and get tighter and force it out wide. Liverpool don't do that very well.
Trent's the most attacking of the defenders. So he will always look like he's the one who's out of position and making the error because he's the one who's not where you expect him to be.
Was it the third goal?
That's true. But I said this the other week. A lot of the goals have nothing to do with how he attacks. That first goal had nothing to do with how he attacks. Liverpool were set up against a breakaway. And he allowed a ball to be slipped through for the winger who ran in behind him. He wasn't attacking at any point in that move. So the second one, the same. He should have held his position. He's got to guard the goal. So it's true, absolutely. And you know, Klopp had an impassioned sort of defence of him about the way they play and how he has to be part of the pressing. I remember being at that Fulham game, and when the other team's got a goal kick, he's pressing like their fullback. It's insane. Like I get all that. But a lot of the goals and a lot of the mistakes have nothing to do with the way that he presses or attacks. It's lapses.
Well, it's spacing behind him that is the problem.
Because he's high up the pitch. But sometimes just because he switches off and he sees let somebody in behind him.
Yesterday, Gregor, I think it was the third goal, Trent is standing in the centre-half position when they're attacking Arsenal. He ends up centre-half, and I think it's Jordan Henderson's in the right-back position, then he tries to recover. But he's started in the centre-half position. I don't get that. If I'm a fullback...
It was a breakaway and there was 3v3.
Yeah, I think he was the last man, and that's just the way it was. But I don't actually... It doesn't matter what position you play, actually. In the 3-on-3, he's just made an error in judgment there. That you shouldn't be going over and leaving a player in the middle of the goal free.
The only way you go over is if Jordan Henderson's completely taken out of the game. And even then, you're going half and half.
Yeah, exactly.
Henderson was still there,
one-on-one with his man. He really shouldn't have run over and it didn't help.
Well, okay, ask the question then. Did anyone here think that Martinelli might cause lots of problems because he chased him behind? Because I bloody well did before the game.
Well, to be honest, that was the only thing I'd say. And it wasn't actually Martinelli who scored the first goal, but it was the intent of Xhaka to overload Trent, which was very clear, even though 58 seconds had passed, because Xhaka made such an effort to get into that area that it was maybe going to be a theme later on in the game. I wasn't too sure it played out that way, but I think there was a bit of an intent there to maybe pick on Trent a little bit from Arsenal. Anyway, look, we dealt with the deciding penalty in the game. Just very quickly, Gabriel, handball from Jota. Was he too close? Was his hand high enough that it should have been a penalty? Would you have said spot kick, Alison?
Yes, but only because the day before there'd been something very similar. So, you know, you think in the Newcastle game, so you think, well, I wouldn't have given either of them, actually, because I do think it's really tough on the person defending when the ball is, you're so close to the ball, and then who's to say your arm is in an unnatural position if you are honestly just trying to do your job? But given that one was given, even though it was close range, I don't see how you can then not give the other one. So, yeah, it should have been a penalty based on recent history.
Everything Al said there, I agree with, because it was, it to me, it was literally Groundhog Day
again,
the day before.
Yeah. Again, I just, I don't want that to be a penalty in the game of football.
No, no.
The big thing with problems, Hugh, is that you're giving someone a spot kick from 12 yards from goal against a one-on-one for something that's...
I had this debate with my mates yesterday.
I just don't get it.
If you, I said this, I actually think you should get a penalty. Imagine you bring a player down, he's one-on-one with goal, but they're 40 yards out. Yeah. But it's just, you've denied a clear goal-scoring opportunity. They're just running through on the goalkeeper. Clearly a goal-scoring opportunity. But if you bring them down, it's just a foul. That should be a penalty, because that is a denial of a goal-scoring opportunity. What shouldn't be a penalty is something that doesn't deny a goal-scoring opportunity. We're not going to go into that debate now, but I'm just underlining that I don't think it should have been a pen, and I just think penalties maybe need to be reassessed. Let's move to events at Goodison Park. Positive evening for Manchester United. Notable for a couple of things. Cristiano Ronaldo's 700th club goal. And despite an error leading to a goal, Casemiro reminding us that there might be a pretty decent player in there if Erik ten Hag actually chooses to use him. Antony scoring in all of his Premier League games as well. Interesting in terms of the impact the winger's made since arriving from Ajax. Let's start with Ronaldo. Gregor, did Cristiano Ronaldo show us that there is a big use for him at Manchester United? Martial, he has been playing well, albeit he suffered an injury as well.
Yeah. Well, look, there is a use for him. It's just that he's still not, all the same issues are still there. His finish was clinical. The way, you know, it's the way of keeping it so low and close to the goalkeeper so he can't get down quick enough to get it. It's a brilliant finish. And we know that. We know that's there, but it's part of the bigger picture in which he's got to kind of press from the front and show energy and sort of bit of dynamism, and he's getting on in years, so it's still going to be difficult for him to be anything other than an impact player, I think, for United, and it's whether he's going to be willing to do that, and I think the answer is no.
I thought United looked better with him on the pitch.
Okay.
They had personality.
Some of his facials at the moment are just like brilliant, aren't they? He's just going, what's going on in his mind? And even when he's coming on the pitch, he's kind of like,
yeah.
And why wouldn't any team want someone with that attitude though, Gregor, with those facial expressions? The sense that he's always on the cusp of history. Always. There's always something about to happen to him because he's scored so many goals, and he's just a phenomenon. I think it's really strange. I can't imagine being a football manager and having him on the bench so much. And he, who knows when he would have come on if there hadn't been an injury. I mean, it's like, you know, he came on in the 29th minute. He probably wouldn't have come on till the 79th had everything gone to Ten Hag's plan. And yet when he did come on, there was just something. I can't imagine any defence thinking, yippee, they've put Ronaldo on. And it doesn't matter how old he is, because I know you mentioned in your column, that, Tony, that you feel he's lost the edge on a lot of things.
Let's
not focus on his age. Look at what you can see happening. He still has. His age hasn't dimmed his self-confidence. And he had pace for his finish, authority with his finish. I just think he just brings a sort of clinical attitude, if not always a clinical edge. I just think United look more like a proper football team when he's playing for them.
When I was mentioning in a column about Father Time, because it does get us all at different times, and he's clearly not the player he once was, and being 37, that's understandable. But he will never, ever lose his belief as, you know, he's got a huge ego, which is great for him, because the inner belief of what he can do in a football field, that in the ultimate moment, you would trust him to deliver. I truly believe Ronaldo's not lost that at all. And he will still get goals, without a doubt, for United this season.
So we're penalising him for not being quite as good as he used to be, but I still think he's better than most.
Well, what's
players.
The difference?
It's about energy. It's about you need to display energy and sort of run around a lot more for the rest of the game. Give him a chance; he's better than anyone else at the club at finishing it. Absolutely, no one's in disagreement.
The difference between a young player that's not ready and an old player that's not quite the player he once was? You know, the bottom line is Ten Hag's made a call on him that he doesn't believe he's going to play week in, week out in his starting lineup. I watched him in midweek in the Europa League. It was difficult for him because the team weren't playing particularly well on the day either. He will still make big things happen this season, in my opinion. And so that's why you want to keep him. I didn't agree with keeping a player of that stature that's achieved so much in the game that you just use him as a bit part player. I thought that was strange by the football club. And you free up a lot of money to go and do something else with maybe the forward you'd want in.
Okay.
You?
All right. Well, as a Manchester United fan, yeah. Look, he had more energy because he hasn't been playing as much. Like, I think ultimately that's what you see. Like, he should play more minutes, probably. Should he start if Martial and Rashford are both fit? I personally don't think so, because I just think what we need right now in terms of the forward areas is that mobility that he's kind of lacked so far. But I think we all agree he's the best goal scorer at the club. I just think he needs to be used more. That's it, really. He will obviously get used more with the injury. But yeah, I think Martial needs some credit as well, because he's had an upturn in form. He has produced something so far this season. A lot of people thought he'd be leaving the football club. So sad that the injuries come for him at this point in time. But in a way, I was thinking about the World Cup, and I think I said this to you the other week, that I think Ronaldo might have been content with just staying fit for the World Cup, knowing with the size of his ego that if he plays well for Portugal, his global legacy will be intact if he has a good World Cup. And obviously, we think we all agree that this is probably his last one, right? So maybe he cares a little bit more about that at this point in time. And the fact that he was getting a bit of a rest meant that we might have seen a fresher Ronaldo at the World Cup, and maybe a sharper Ronaldo at the World Cup, because he won't have been as worn out by the Premier League. So maybe he's a little bit sad that he's going to be starting every week. That's all I'm saying at this point.
You did say, Gregor, conspiracy theories.
Another handball to address in this game, Marcus Rashford's goal disallowed. The question here being about a second phase, because we'll come on to Mikel Antonio's against Fulham. In fact, I might as well introduce it now. Antonio's was very similar to Marcus Rashford. Skipped past the defender, both of them. There was a little ricochet. Clearly hit both of their hands. Antonio basically had an opportunity to score. The goalkeeper rebuffed it. It came back to him and then he scored, which was seen as a second phase of play. So the handball didn't come into it. Marcus Rashford tried to go around Jordan Pickford, who did get a leg onto the ball, but because it continued onto goal and he then scored, it wasn't another phase. So should they both have been given? Should they both have been disallowed? What's going on?
Well, no, this is weird thing that I mean, honestly, if we rewound 10 years, you wouldn't make this up, that for some reason we've reached the point where if the ball touches your hand, even tiny, 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 tiny amount, and you're not even aware of it as the player, and it has no bearing on anything at all, but if there's some touch, then that makes the goal completely invalid, ruled it out. And we all know, so to have ruled out Antonio's goal because of that tiny, tiny, tiny touch that he had he couldn't really do much about it. It was incidental. Everyone knows that would be stupid to rewind to make a goal invalid because of that. And that's why they introduced the phases of play, because you can't have this incy wincy touch ruling out goals. But why they decided that had to be there in the first place is absolutely ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. But it, in terms of the way the law is, the right goal was disallowed because of the phases of play. I mean, yes, but it's the rule that's wrong.
But I actually
just talk about common sense here again. Like, can we not just talk about that? As Alison said, if there's nothing you can do about it, and it's not like this is one moment where you could actually use the term unnatural body position. So, like, if your arm is away from you, it ricochets, hits your arm, and goes down. Fair enough, because it's not even like within the boundaries of your body. Both of these would have hit his body anyway. You know, it's got to be something pretty clear, like clear and obvious. All these phrases have been thrown into my mind, and I hate it. They're just common sense. There's no way on earth that these should be penalised.
I wouldn't have given either of them, personally. Because
what the heck are we doing?
The common sense, and I agree with you on that point, but the common sense should be, you know, sometimes, and you of course, both of you know this from playing, and you, Alison, too, that sometimes the ball, you know, you might go into a challenge, the ball spins up, and it's not flying off in a different trajectory. It maybe rolls up your body and then it rolls up the arm, for example, but it's going to land in the same spot. You haven't affected really where the ball is going. But in these two incidents, the handball does affect whether the players can basically get it under control or not. If it doesn't hit the arm, they don't control them going in on goal.
Can we not?
And that's why I don't think they should be allowed. That's the only reason, right? Cool. Not that it hit their hand, but that it hit their hand and allowed them to have the ball in a position to score.
So, can we just assert, can we not recognise accidental?
Listen, it will, Tony, go back to that. Believe me, it will go back to being, was it deliberate handball or was it accidental?
Well, it will
go back to that because there's so many variations of a handball now.
But you can find...
It's like the fifth terrace act.
But even Scamacca's, like, so what if it hit his hand? I don't care. It would have had no influence on... Unless it really hit his hand and, like, you know, he's controlled it with his hand. It clipped his knuckles. It doesn't matter. But his finish was sublime. And the ball was there. No. It barely changed it.
It might have clipped his knuckles. Well, the only reason we know for sure it clipped his knuckles is he didn't celebrate.
I bet that could have been... Oh. You could have said that was offside.
But this is what I'm saying, okay? Those examples, both of them, if you like, at the West Ham game, are what I'm talking about. Scamacca's brushes his hand, doesn't really affect where the ball's going. I would have said that goal should stand. Mikel Antonio would not have got the ball under control had it not hit his arm. And therefore, I think that goal shouldn't have stood because it would have just gone off for a throw, probably, had it not touched his arm.
You can give it...
More violently, the Rashford one, because I think that... All right, it hits his chest, but it... You know, he wouldn't have got it under control.
Yeah. I think unless
you can give an example of everything.
Yeah.
Everything has an example. Now, for me, you can make this a lot simpler by going accidental. Do you think he actually deliberately tried to hand that ball? Yeah, and then you can come to some conclusion.
It's got to be like you're actually hitting the ball into your path. You know what I mean?
Okay. Listen, we've got about 2 minutes left.
Too much about handball.
And we could go on and on and on. So very quickly, and the Bournemouth fans will hate us for this. Gregor, I know you wanted to give a brief mention to Gary O'Neill, enhancing his credentials a bit further to become the next permanent Bournemouth manager. An impressive comeback victory over Leicester this weekend. 5 games unbeaten. And it comes after another comeback against Nottingham Forest last month as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable. I think they conceded 16 goals in the 3 games preceding Scott Parker's dismissal. And now they've conceded 4 and 5, 2 clean sheets. Mm. This is good work in the training ground. And, you know, I don't think there was any point where anyone thought he was going to have any chance of being the Bournemouth manager.
Yeah.
Particularly because there's a takeover and, you know, imminently going to go through. American investor Bill Foley, I think it's about £150 million.
How much does it undermine Scott Parker? Because he said he didn't, at the start of the season when they were losing games, didn't have enough players good enough.
Yeah, well, it certainly makes his public utterances seem very stupid now, absolutely. But even if he did think that, I don't think you need to say it in public. Mm. He was angry about the way that they dealt with their summer business, but a lot of that was because of who their owner was. Max and Damon, Russian, a lot of his money was kind of, I think he was impacted by the war in Ukraine slightly, and he was looking to sell the club, so he didn't really want to spend any money in the summer. Mm. That message transmits to the players, doesn't it? Mm. So Gary Neal's come in, and I think he's been a breath of fresh air. Ryan Christie said after the game that, you know, the players really want him to be the manager, and they look like he's I think it looks tank. Like when they take their I think he said it actually when they take their handbrake off, when they kind of, you know, throw caution to the wind a little bit, they look like a good team, and he's right. When they were kind of on the front foot, they've looked like a really good team. And, you know, it's, I think if you look at their fixtures now as well, they've got Fulham, Southampton, West Ham, you know, all reasonably winnable games, and then Spurs, Leeds, Everton before the World Cup. I think there's a good chance that the job will be his before the World Cup.
You agree?
Well, it should be, because I think that's one of the big turnarounds we've seen in football in recent times. Yeah. You lose 9-0 at Anfield and your manager says, well, you know, this is what happens when you don't invest. And then you go on the run that you've been on.
Yeah, they've lost Lloyd Kelly as well, who's their best defender. But there's kind of, as I say, they just look well organised. A lot of the time when they're out of possession, it's like 2 banks of 4 and it's pretty simple.
And they're enjoying themselves. They look like a proper team having fun.
Yeah. difficult place to go to again. So Bournemouth, little Bournemouth, kind of.
Little Bournemouth are back, basically. Yeah. Okay, well, look, we'll see if Gary O'Neill does get that job. Plenty more still to come on the Game Podcast, by the way. Remember, if you're enjoying it, rate us, leave us a review, and make sure you're subscribed.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
So, is the European Super League back? Barcelona's president, Joan Laporta, has claimed that a European Super League is needed to deal with financial doping by state-owned clubs such as Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain. You may well scoff, given the situation Barcelona are currently in. But in a speech to the club's General Assembly, Laporta said a revised Super League format would no longer be a closed competition for founder members. Maybe that was one of the key points, that they were pulling up the drawbridge, if you like, on the rest of European football. Let's get the latest on this with Martin Ziegler, The Times, a chief sports reporter who's been following the story. Martin, how alive is the ESL? And what clubs are still believing that it could happen soon?
It's still kicking and causing trouble. But I'm not sure how likely it is to happen, mainly because I don't think the English clubs could possibly join one now because of their, you know, the way things have happened and the guarantees they've had to give to the Premier League and the agreements that they would, you know, forfeit points and huge amounts of money and everything if they did join a breakaway league again. I think they'd even, you know, they'd even face expulsion from the Premier League. So I suppose a big question is, could there be a European Super League without any English teams? I don't think they could.
Martin, how much money would they have to, you know, what would the fine be if English clubs were to kind of go back on their word, if that's worth anything?
I have to go back to my emails now.
Sorry, I put you on the spot there. That's why I asked you. I don't know. We were trying to...
No, the thing is, there would be... Look, there'd be punishments and there'd be sanctions, but imagine all of the other big clubs outside of England sign up to a new competition. Would we be expecting the Premier League or the FA to turn around to the big six clubs in England and say, you're just going to have to stay in the Champions League and play against the teams from, I don't know, Scandinavia and Scotland, and, you know, TNS might get in there as well. You know, like, without the other big European clubs, all right, it's not a great competition without the English clubs, but if the others all sign up to it, I think our owners might be in the position of saying, well, we kind of need to be in it as well, wouldn't they?
Well, they'd probably say it, but they, you know, they have signed these agreements that they, you know, if they want to stay in the Premier League, I think it would be extremely difficult. I mean, there might be a sort of another lengthy legal battle in England to try and allow them to do it. And I think it's quite complicated. I mean, I don't think Paris Saint-Germain, I think the way they've aligned themselves, they wouldn't join. I mean, you can just see it from what, you know, Juan Laporta was saying. You know, that we need this to combat the state-owned clubs, Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain. I mean, probably down the line, Newcastle United. So they're not going to rush to join in with Real Madrid and Barcelona and Juventus in a sort of Does that sound like a great competition to you? That Real Madrid, you know, playing each other all the time? It doesn't sound great to me if no English clubs are going to be involved and no Paris Saint-Germain and probably no Bayern Munich, because they didn't join in the last one either.
Okay, I see what you're saying
here. This is heartening stuff. He was very sceptical this morning before we spoke to you, Martin.
The power of the ultra-capitalist society that we currently live in, it's got to me. I just believe that money will eventually talk. That's all I'm saying. And if there's enough money on one side of it, Tony, look, we've seen it in golf, haven't we?
Yeah, Live Tour.
Then some of the big names might gravitate towards it.
I would say on the Live Tour, which you could sort of, Martin, you know, could that happen to football? Because Live Tour seems to be throwing incredible amounts of money at players that some have bought into and have ignored the fact that they're not going to get ranking points or play in the major competition. So could football be forced down that road?
On a sort of geopolitical, global level, I mean, the way it could happen is, say, for example, Saudi Arabia decide that they're going to join forces with FIFA and try and sort of disrupt UEFA. And as a result of that, they're sort of, you know, the Saudis get behind a new competition. They sort of guarantee lots of money. Some, you know, I don't know. It's not going to be straightforward. I think there's a lot of a lot of noise being generated by Barcelona, Real Madrid and Juventus in the last week. I think there's still a very, very long way from getting anything significant.
The European Court of Justice and this case, I think the future of the European Super League, you say, hinges on the outcome of it. Is there any early indication as to what we might find out?
Well, I think sort of legal opinion, you know, independent legal opinion, obviously they're not the ones making the decision, but sort of sports lawyers I've spoken to, they don't think the Super League rebels will win, but I think that they will. The ruling may be that UEFA needs to give more control of its competitions over to the clubs, like, for example, to the European Club Association. I mean, there's already a joint venture, and we're already seeing the clubs are getting, having a lot more part of the decision-making process about the Champions League, and you know that's partly why there's this sort of expanded format. So whether the European Court of Justice says that has to even increase even further, I guess that's possible. But I don't think that doesn't suit Real Madrid and Juventus and Barcelona. They want to be the top. Their big problem is that they've fallen behind the English clubs, and they've stated that really. They know that the Premier League internationally is going to be a much, much stronger product than their leagues. They can see the way the overseas TV rights have gone. I think that this is a sort of, they think this is their only way of trying to get back on some sort of level terms. And that's another question, is why would the English clubs want to join in with that? Because they've got this great advantage. So why sacrifice that advantage?
Okay, Martin Ziegler, thank you for joining us on the game with that update on the European Super League. Before we started the podcast, we had a bit of an argument about this between us as to whether we think it might happen. Obviously, you all know I'm deeply cynical and I believe that money talks in this world and eventually it will. The Champions League's been changed once, twice, a few times now. And even if it doesn't become the European Super League, as Martin alluded to, all we might see is, to stop the European Super League happening, the power of European football given more to the bigger clubs, as they try to do with the Premier League, and consolidate the power with the top six. Now the big clubs in Europe want to consolidate UEFA into their hands. That could easily happen without any of us noticing.
Yeah, although the power has already was shifted away from Barcelona and Real Madrid and Juventus because of the first Super League debacle. And it's now, ironically, been shifted into the hands of Paris Saint-Germain owner. Mm. There are undoubtedly power plays that lie ahead, and this might be one of them. But I just think if we come back to English clubs, for many reasons, they would be absolutely insane to try and revisit this, rekindle any interest in joining. I understand that there could be a world in which there's a rival competition to the Champions League, as you're alluding to, and it would look very appealing to English clubs to join it. But I think if there's anything that's going to threaten their position in the Premier League, then which it does, because of the sanctions that Martin pointed out, there would be another uprising by supporters. Just make me underline that. Not me.
No, okay.
Haven't we already got a European Super League? It's called the Premier League, who spends over $2 billion on transfers. Now, Real Madrid had to win the Champions League last year by literally getting over the most incredible... Well, it's the eighth wonder of the world how they won the Champions League last year, because they overcome everything that was thrown at them. But the Premier League is so powerful, it's quite obvious all the other leagues are looking at the Premier League and thinking, we can't compete with them. Maybe, certainly on finance they can't. There is PSG, but after PSG, Bayern Munich can't compete with what Man United could do and what Man City could do, even maybe Newcastle. So it is a problem, because our own domestic league is already too powerful.
But this is why I think a European Super League without Premier League clubs might be appealing to a lot of those other clubs in Europe, because they look at the Premier League and they think, how are we ever going to compete? And I this is the strange thing, because we talk about the big clubs, Juventus and Barcelona, who might want to be in Real Madrid in the European Super League. But I'm looking at it as, like, if you're one of the smaller teams in the Champions League that don't get one of the big shares of the pie, which one is going to be more appealing to you? If you're, I don't know, Copenhagen, with the breakaway one where you get five times as much money.
Are you saying that Barcelona and Real Madrid and Juventus are now
in a Super
pleading for the likes of Copenhagen to join them in
No, I'm not. But what I'm saying is, if you can create a competition, imagine there are just two competitions. One's the Champions League as we know it. The other one is the breakaway league, like we spoke about in golf, for example. And one competition offers you five times as much money as the other, that being the breakaway league. Yeah. Now, it's all good for us to say, the Premier League clubs don't need to go into it. Why would they break away from the Champions League? But I'm talking about, what if you're, I don't know, Napoli? What if you finish fourth in Italy every year? You're not going to win either of these competitions. It's just about the finances for you. Which competition is your owner going to want to be in? The one that you get £200 million, finishing third in the group, or the one that you get £30 million or £40 million for finishing third in the group?
By the way, Juventus are playing in front of quite a half-full stadium, like Barcelona are at the moment. Now, there is a real product problem in European football. And that's why they're using all their muscle to try and create something that gives them revenue to be as competitive as they've always been. When the Galacticos were at Real Madrid, they can't do that now.
There's an argument that the Premier League is doing to European football what it's done for several decades now to the Football League, to the rest of the pyramid.
Yeah,
It's kind of an upward drag. It's creating inflation, and we've seen it. I mean, look, Real Madrid and Barcelona's revenues aren't exactly, tinkling.
Paltry, yeah.
So they've made some serious mistakes, they've been badly run, but it has half a point that they're trying to compete now with nation-state-owned clubs. So it's just a completely backward method of, tackling that problem. You've got to tackle it with regulation and spending. It's got to, it's the same way, and it's the same
in England.
Barcelona
ignored all that, Gregor. This summer they ignored
I know, and they even challenged the authority of the governing body. This is the world we're living in now. That's why they want to go off and take it away and do it themselves.
But stories come out about investigations into the state-backed clubs in terms of their spending. Nothing materialises from it. There are no bans. Those clubs seemingly can spend whatever they want. So there's no point saying regulation will solve the problem. They brought in financial fair play. The problem still spiralled out of control.
Okay, so what's the alternative? We just hand over control to the clubs and they decide how we distribute revenue?
No, but you're saying you're saying that their position's the wrong one. I'm saying, their position is, we can't stop the others from spending money, so we might as well fill our pockets with as much money as we can so that we've got at least half a chance of competing with them.
But at least at the moment,
as a capitalist, which I am, I fully endorse this.
At least at the moment, there is a means of distribution that's like, it's being pushed to its limits, but it's even far greater kind of level playing field in Premier League than it is in the rest of Europe, a lot of major leagues. It still is in the Champions League, although that's been stretched as well. So as I say again, if you hand the power to the richest and wealthiest and biggest clubs, do you think that's going to stay the same? No, it's the end of fair competition.
You said you're a capitalist. Well, free trade isn't really in football, is it?
Fair competition was a stretch too far. It's the end of like any semblance of balanced competition.
Alison, what do you think? I'm right, aren't I?
What staggers me is that we listen to these old men who are they're like in those dramas about old money versus new money. And they dress up in their top hats and exactly. tails, and they want cocktail parties, and they want things to be the way they always were, and to keep the riffraff out. They're just clinging to some semblance of the old ways, whilst, as Gregor pointed out, not running their own businesses terribly well at all.
Well,
it's embarrassing. The speeches that are coming out about the Super League are embarrassing because, as you alluded to, Hugh, now they're alienating the new money, it would not be a Super League at all. It would be the team of the badly run old guard.
Who are they playing?
Whoever signs up to it.
Yeah, but
you just have to give a compelling case.
But
Live Golf gave 200 million compelling cases
to a few. Golf is the new money, not the old money.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying if there's a new competition, you're saying
who sell it if they've got no one decent to play against?
Well, yeah, look, what you took the golf. Cameron Smith, who is a great golfer, okay, I don't even think he's 30 yet. He left the PGA purely to go to Live Golf with a sign-on fee of 200 million. That, to me, was the biggest shock, that someone of his stature, it's not the Tiger Woods at his heyday or Rory McIlroy, but a golfer of a very high talent. Dustin Johnson was in the top 10 in the world. He left. You know, so it started slowly and people thought no one would go across, and now suddenly there's like, well, there's enough players for a tournament.
But I say it again, there are not fans in golf who will run onto the
green
and like rip out the hole and, you know, I don't know, tear up the green. That's what fans will do. We saw it. We saw a glimpse of it. And if there's any prospect of this being, you know, brought back to life in with regards to English clubs, they will do it again.
I'm not sure.
We saw them as protectors. And we can also have, we had a conversation just beforehand briefly about there's a new, you know, younger generation of fans who don't really, you know, I still think there's tradition passed on in England about still that it's important that the clubs have roots in the soil here. So there's a new global fan, a new generation of global fan, and there's enough money and fandom there to support a new competition like this.
But
need the traditional fans here.
There is also a tradition of supporting your club come what may. And ultimately, a lot of football clubs...
No, we saw that's not true.
...could sign some spectacular footballers. Fans then get excited. They start talking about the prospect of winning the Premier League. Most of them couldn't care less about winning the European competition anyway. So it's just like, oh, well, this competition provides us with the money to go out and try and win the Premier League. It gives us a great squad. So we might as well be in it. Who cares about whether we win it or not?
What do you think would happen if this money was created for football clubs? They'd even pay players way more than they're getting now.
Yeah.
Okay. So the best players would end up going, you will get a number of them.
750 grand a week for all of us, basically, all 22 players, all 25 players.
Well, part of the Super League package was to limit spending to, I think it was 55% of revenues. Yeah. So where did the money really go? To the owners of the clubs. That's another reason they wanted to do it. So they could actually see their way of turning profit rather than losing money. So, you know.
Most of them go way over that, Hugh, don't they? Over 55%.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
it's a figure that's
there.
Trying to
get 70 now.
Ignored.
But, yeah.
Okay, all right. Listen, we could have done a European Super League special once again. All we can say is it might happen, it might not. We got to no conclusion on it. Clearly, some people would be very unhappy about it, Gregor namely. Listen, more still to come. We'll be talking about the Lionesses game at Wembley on Friday night and what the former Spain goalkeeper Iker Casillas and the error that he made this weekend means for football as a whole. This is The Game. Remember, if you're enjoying it, make sure you're subscribed. Friday night was pretty spectacular. More than 76,000 fans at Wembley Stadium to see the European champions England beating the world champions the United States for the first time since 2017. I'm not sure about the performances, but it was end-to-end. Molly Hudson joins us from The Times. What do you think we learnt at Wembley on Friday night? Because we spoke about England missing a couple of key players. They went out, they won the game. Maybe could have gone either way. Maybe a draw would have been fair. How did you see it?
I agree with you. I think maybe a draw would have been fair, but I think it showed that England could cope without those players missing that we talked about, particularly Liam Williamson. Obviously, defence has been sort of an area where England have struggled before Serena came in, and obviously most of the success under Serena has been with Liam Williamson at the heart of that. So I think, although obviously long-term, we won't want to see England without Liam Williamson, I think it will have given her sort of confidence, the Eagleman, that actually England can cope when they're in those sort of situations, because we know at the Euros England were remarkably lucky with the victories that they had in terms of the injuries. You know, they literally went through pretty much the whole tournament without any injuries to key players. I think the main thing for me coming away from that game was the mentality. I think we often talk about how England are ahead of England and the USA are ahead of England, and not just England but everyone else, because of their winning mentality. And I think you saw that when England had that lead to project late on in the game. In the past, they probably would have panicked and maybe they would have drawn that game. But now with the Serena, they have that confidence and they have that belief. And, you know, I think it's, even though it's only a friendly, and even though I think quite a lot of the game was spent kind of watching VAR replays, I think England will take confidence from that, just the fact that they've beaten the United States.
Do you think it sends a message then, ahead of the World Cup, that we should be there in the latter stages, competing, maybe beating the best in the world?
I think it does, but I also think that England were already there. I think Vladimir Andonovsky, the United States manager, said after the game that, you know, he'd quite like to meet England again in a World Cup final, and that's the level that England are at now. You know, they, having won the Euros in particular, they've gone over that sort of final hurdle, I suppose, of beating that kind of semi-final where they just sort of plateaued for a number of years. Now they really are capable of going out and winning tournaments, and, you know, we should do what the United States have done. We should have that level of arrogance now that, you know, we should expect that. And if we don't get there, then, you know, that will be a failure now. That's how high the bar has been set under Serena.
There is something else that I wanted to discuss with you, Molly, and it was a strange episode over the weekend. The former Real Madrid and Spain goalkeeper Iker Casillas deleting a tweet where he basically tweeted saying that he was gay. He afterwards said that his account was hacked. And his former Spain teammate Carlos Puyol had already replied to that initial tweet saying it's time to tell our story. The tweet was live for more than an hour before being deleted. Both of them subsequently apologised. During that space of time, there were plenty of big figures in the game, in many ways congratulating Casillas for his bravery, if you like, and sending him the respect that he'd asked for in that tweet. But there were also many, many people, regular football fans, tweeting many homophobic tweets, excuse me, during that period of time, which was incredibly sad to see. And I just wonder what your view was on this entire episode and where you think it leaves us.
I think actually it's quite ironic, because we've just been talking about women's football, how many players are out and, you know, have really, I suppose, taken that fight against homophobia in football, and they've shown that you can be, you know, a functioning, you know, professional footballer, and it's not a problem. I think the men's game is light years behind that, and I think that's been shown this weekend. I think I'm part of a sports media LGBTQIA+ group, and I think it was one of those where you read the tweet and you thought, oh, this is exactly what we want, somebody that has come out so simply, in a way. You know, there were no sort of fireworks. It was just a tweet. You know, I'm gay, respect me. It almost did feel too good to be true. And I think it's just so sadly predictable, the response. I think I tweeted that, you know, it's remarkable how out of touch you can be in a year, well, in the coming months, where we're going into a World Cup in Qatar, where you can be prosecuted for being homosexual. And I think just sort of not reading the room, in a way, of how many professional footballers are clearly hiding their sexuality because they feel as though they can't come out. And those that have come out, and what a big step that's been, the step forward. I mean, Josh Cavallo tweeted yesterday to say it was, you know, such a, I think he said it was beyond disappointed to see somebody that he idolised in football kind of treat sexuality as a joke, right? And I think it's just such a shame to see not only the reaction, but also that Casillas felt that that was okay to tweet. I mean, he said he's been hacked. It very much seemed as though it was a joke. I know the Spanish media were reporting that it was because it, you know, been linked with a string of women in the press. So I think, yeah, I think it just showed maybe how far men's football in particular has to come in order to, and, you know, Casillas is not even a former professional footballer now. So I think it just shows how far it has to come, really.
The one reason I felt the tweets were not real straight away was because the big problem, I think, with men's football and players coming out is most male footballers are encouraged still to have a traditional lifestyle, and most footballers have wives or girlfriends. So if they come out, they're not coming out on their own. They're involving their whole families in what was a lie. So it goes much more deep than a tweet or having the bravery, in inverted commas, to tell the truth, because you're not just talking about yourself. If you've played along with the image that you're supposed to portray as a professional male footballer, that will be that you are, if you're not in a long-term relationship, you are constantly photographed in the company of women. And therefore, if you were to tweet, "Please respect me, I'm gay," you're actually saying, "Oh, and I've been disrespecting all the women I've had relationships with and the people I've lied to over the years." It's a really deep thing that cannot be... I mean, I'm surprised you were sort of pleased that it was a tweet and it was so simple, because it wouldn't have been simple, would it? Because he's one of, I don't know, 99% of footballers who are married to women. So you can't just tweet something that makes your whole life a lie.
I think hadn't he recently split up with...
Last year.
Yeah.
But that would still make a lie of the marriage he did have, wouldn't it? And the relationships he's been having since.
Yeah, I suppose it would. I suppose there's a reason that, you know, not because he has in this case, but there's a reason that footballers believe that they have to hide who they are. And that doesn't make it right, but quite clearly we're not in a society where they feel as though they can be who they are. I think, you know, it's not quite the same, but we've seen players that kind of dress differently or maybe, you know, support different causes on social media kind of get consistent abuse because they don't fit the norm. And I think that's a problem that kind of men football still has, that very sort of, it is sort of old-fashioned view of what a footballer is, I suppose. And yeah, I suppose it did feel too good to be true, that it couldn't just be a tweet, "This is who I am," because obviously we've seen with footballers coming out in the past, it becomes a huge sort of multimedia sort of PR exercise to try and ensure you're getting the right message across when you do come out. So I think it was never likely to be true, but I think there was also a feeling in a few of the sort of group chats that I'm in of surely it's 2022 and you can't be joking about something like that. Surely you must not be naive enough to know what tweeting that is going to do. But clearly Casillas was.
There's no two ways about the, you know, Molly, you're absolutely right that the men's game is miles behind the women's game in this regard. But one thing I would say is that we need to be careful not to extrapolate too much from one incident what it says about the men's game, because I think there have been great strides made in the men's game. I think really primarily it says a lot about these two guys, and like, I know they go down your estimation a little bit. It is tenured, as we say, particularly in the, because of where the World Cup is going to be this winter. I just think we can be slightly too quick to say this means something about the men's game. I'm not sure it does. I think it says something a lot about two men.
I saw the reaction and thought it would say a lot about what a current player would get if they were in a stadium, in terms of the reaction from those faceless mob fans on social media. I wouldn't have expected players to get abuse if they came out as being homosexual in a stadium. But when I saw the abuse on social media, I thought, if it's like this on social media...
Yeah, but it's social media. Look, there will be idiots in stadiums who would, but I still think we've come quite a long way, and I'm not certain that that's true, actually, now. I think that certainly home support would be, you know, greatly in support of a player who did that. And then there would be idiots, and you would probably hear some, you know, unsavoury chants and whatnot, but I think we've come a long way. Yeah. And
sad thing to say and then say we've come a long way.
My only reservation about this is not just the actions of two guys who've made a really off-colour joke and, you know, will undoubtedly regret it. I don't think that says, that necessarily is reflective of where the men's game is at now.
I'd agree. I think there's a part of me, and I've said this for quite a number of years, that the game is ready for men to come out. And when the reaction happened, as it did the other day, and when there was a Scottish player recently who came out, didn't he, who was playing in the SPL, is that right, Gregor?
Lower leagues.
Well, he came out. But the scramble to get to him by the media was incredible. They've created the biggest story of... And I'm like, well, okay, he's coming out. That's a really brave thing to do. football is ready, in my opinion, for a player to come out. I don't think it is the 1980s or 1990s and before. I feel it is, and there is a number of issues, and that Alison's touched on one of them. But the game would embrace it, generally, but you are never going to get away from certain people or their religious beliefs that would make it a problem for them. But I generally, like in the women's game, it's accepted and no one's really... It's not a big deal. I think we are ready right now. I think that they will get an incredible support.
They will get support from their clubs, from their managers and from their teammates. That's been the crucial change, I think, in the last 10 years, maybe 5 years. But whenever I've interviewed players or managers about it, you know, they will bend over backwards to say, if a player wants to come to me and talk to me about it, I will help them come out in the dressing room. You know,
captains
feel it's their role to encourage people to be open and honest. It's the fans. It's seen as a tool in which to.
Do you think we might be surprised? Somebody. Do you think we might be surprised by a fans' reaction? There's a big part of me that thinks, I'm being a little bit ignorant here. If I'm thinking, not every fan in the country is going to suddenly be chanting at players.
Not every fan, but
an audible minority.
Even a minority. I'm not convinced by that. I think there were certain clubs that could be worse than others. I think we'd probably all understand, you know, that argument. But I really feel like it's a reaction of the media. Having a radio phone in straight after the tweet went out. You know, people scrambling, and it's a mistake. It's a fake tweet. It doesn't even get checked.
Molly, what do you think? Your final word on this?
I understand what everyone's saying, but I think if you just look at the behaviour of, and it is a small section of football fans, in various kind of sections of society that we don't want involved in football, whether it's racism, you know, we've seen kind of chants directed towards Chelsea players just for playing for Chelsea or Brighton because they have links to the LGBT community. I think, sadly, I think, as Gregor says, we've come a long way, but I still think there's a long way to go in the men's game. And as somebody that's covered men's and women's football, you just don't get that in women's football. And sadly, in men's football, you still do. It may be a small section, but that small section, imagine if you're a player that hears that. Obviously, whoever comes up first is going to be brave, and they will get that support from their teammates. They will get the support from the club, and you know, from the vast majority. But sadly, you are still going to have to deal with that minority.
Okay, Molly Hudson, thank you for joining us. I know you've got to go off and speak to Serena Wiegmann now ahead of England's game against the Czech Republic tomorrow night, is it?
Yes.
All right, okay, yes. Brilliant. Thank you. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast as well, thetimes.co.uk/thegame. Thank you all for listening. We will see you again on Thursday. Take care.